Okay. Wow, I love that song. And if my wife's response means anything, she really loved it too. So, terrific. Thank you. Well, I'm back. Hi. Thanks. Oh. Can you say more about that? So, Leslie contacted me, as she does from time to time. Would you care to come out and say a few words about something? And I said, sure. She said, you know, great. And I said, so what's the theme? And she said, oh, they're really big questions. And I said, great. And, you know, then I foolishly asked, has anybody done free will and determinism yet? And then she foolishly replied, no. And so here we are, stuck with that topic, the topic that has turned generations of Philosophy 101 students to consider business as a major. So, all right. So, well, gee, if it's so bad, why are you talking about it? Because it gives me a chance to talk about science and biology in particular, and that's where I'm headed with the help of Robert Sapolsky, the polymath at Stanford, biologist, primatologist, neurobiologist, and maybe Margaret. Mine is basically a book report, too, because I don't have anything terribly original to say about it, but it does give me a chance to talk about the ways in which science, the advances in science, yet again change culture and hopefully policy and law. Before I get into biology, though, just a short recap of the history of free will and determinism, or at least a few things that have been influential. excuse me, I hope this is not triggering for anybody raised in the Christian tradition, but you'll recall Augustine, who had as much to say about free will and determinism early on as any of the Christian theologians. We are, you know, there's this notion of predestination. Some folks are among the select. Is this okay? Are you okay? We're among the select, right? Some, you don't really know it, and only through God's grace can you act freely, but even then, only if God takes the obstacles out of your way to act freely, and, you know, on it goes. And I don't want to talk about it, but I sometimes wonder, you know, for those of us who are raised in that tradition, at one point I was going to be a Christian theologian. That's what I went off to, originally to graduate school to do. And it's, you know, it's, you know, maybe not very nice, but sometimes I just imagine these guys sitting around in their rooms thinking, maybe they're just, like, messing with us, right? It's like, oh, yeah, predestination. And the other guys go, well, what is that? It's like, well, there's some people who are select, but they don't know it. And they start laughing, you know, and they're like, yeah, can you believe anybody takes this seriously? And then somebody else says, oh, yeah, well, whoops, sorry. What about double predestination? Yeah? And like some people are here just to go to hell, you know? It's like, oh, yeah, that's great. Put that in there. And then somebody else goes, oh, yeah, well, I'll see your double predestination and raise you the doctrine of the Trinity. You know, it's like, so, all right, I don't want to talk about that. So that's one. The other one is, there are many of them, but another one is, I'll need a book for this one. We're all living in a simulation. David Chalmers, who's philosopher, probably done as much to talk about and help us think about consciousness as anybody out there. This is his new book, Reality Plus, Virtual Worlds and the Problems of Philosophy. You can't prove that we're not living in a simulation, but it does help philosophers and psychologists and others think about, all right, the ways in which consciousness and autonomy, et cetera, maybe act as a kind of bulwark against living in a simulation. The only thing I actually would be fine with living in a simulation, because it means that Keanu Reeves is actually the prophet of our times, whether as Neo or as John Wick, and I'm perfectly fine with either one. So that's, and then maybe the last one, Buddhism, that helps lead us into the main topic here. Everything is conditioned from time immemorial. Every thought, every action, every bit of speech. In the Abhidharma Kosha, the Buddhist philosophers talk about us creating 64,000 karmas, actions that imprint on us a second. Okay, try to ferret all that out. But what they really want to talk about, what they want to say, is everything's cause and effect. It's basic doctrine of cause and effect. We shouldn't be surprised that we are conditioned, perhaps even determined by everything we've thought, done, and said, yeah, not only in this prior, in this lifetime, but all previous lifetimes. But then they offer an escape valve, as almost all religions, philosophies, psychologies, and individuals do. They say, right, it's all pretty much cause and effect, it's all pretty much determined, but there's this thing called Buddha nature, the ghost in the machine, God consciousness. Sapolsky talks about it as the homunculus. It's the thing that's in the brain but not of the brain, and we appeal to that as our way out of being solely locked into a deterministic universe and to help us think that we do, in fact, have something like free will. All the biology, all the environmental stuff, all the in utero wiring, all the genetics, all the stuff that science just keeps telling us we're actually made up of, sure, that's all there. But in a really important moment when I need to, I can just appeal to something outside of the brain. Again, people call it different things depending on your tradition. I'll go with homunculus. He's got it pictured as this like tiny little guy in an office somewhere in your brain. He's like kind of monitoring everything else that's going on in your head, but in some ways, you know, touched by it and sometimes untouched by it. And then I can rise above all of that, my environment, my past, my history, all of my genetics, all of, you know, the biological stuff that's happened, brain damage, who knows, everything that's going on, what I ate this morning, and somehow making a decision that's free of all other influences. And that's what a lot of people mean by mitigated free will. Somehow I can do that. Almost everybody believes that, I think, right? Almost nobody believes that we're solely and wholly determined. And almost nobody believes that there's unfettered free will somehow just in a vacuum, okay? So he spends a fair bit of one of the chapters essentially taking apart mitigated free will, because he says even if there's like 99% of the time you're thinking, right, everything is causes and conditions and, you know, I can't escape any of that. That one moment where you say, yeah, but I really did freely choose the vanilla over the chocolate, then he said you're still positing that homunculus, and that's going to get us all in trouble because that's folk psychology. There's no real basis in science for any of that. So then he starts building his positive case for a positive case for the complete lack of free will. And here's how he starts. He says, if a person's leg is fractured, how predictable is it that they will have trouble walking? So I think it'd be safe to say 100%. If they have a serious inflammatory lung disease, how predictable is it that their breathing would be labored at times, tire easily? It's right around 100%. Same for all kinds of physical ailments. Science, and medical science in particular, has gotten to the point pretty predictability is really, really good if you can point to the ailment, right? Switch to the brain and neurological dysfunction. What if somebody's had a brain injury and the neurons around the resulting scar tissue rewire so that they stimulate both themselves and one another? How predictable is it that the person will have a seizure? And he goes on to give another couple cases like that. And with the imaging and all the tools that neuroscience has now, close to 100% on that, too. But now, broader range of behaviors. How predictable is it that this person with the frontal damage will do something horrifically violent at some point? Or that someone who is abused repeatedly as a child will become an abusive adult? That a soldier who went through a traumatic injury or a situation will develop PTSD? That certain kinds of in utero wiring will lead to very high IQs? Far less predictability, 40% and lower for almost all of that. It says, but so how do a fractured leg and the predictability around that and the unpredictability of certain kinds of behaviors differ? Do the latter somehow involve less biology? Is the point that the brain contains a non-biological homunculus that the leg bones do not? And he wants to argue not. And he's going to go into something that parallels what gets called the God of the gaps. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that argument, right? As science and other fields of human knowledge developed, starting especially in the 17th century, theologians go on the defensive. So in anything that can't be explained by these new burgeoning sciences, well, that's where God is. Now, you might have explained that by nature, but God is still here. And you obviously the obvious problem, right, is that God becomes this thing that gets squeezed into ever narrower gaps. And Sapolsky wants to argue that's what's happening with free will, as it should. As the sciences and biology in particular increase their predictability power by understanding that there are so many different factors, environmental and strictly biological, but environmental in the sense that they impinge on the physical and the biological, we're going to end up with a free will of the gaps, and that people are going to keep sort of just trying to find that homunculus somewhere, somehow, to keep intact some notion of autonomy, perhaps human dignity, and of course the big one, which is responsibility or accountability. And he'll talk about that in just a second. But he goes on to say, look, you know, if you start thinking about everything that we've learned in the last even 100 years, we've already done the big major work to get to a point where human beings can say it's not him or her, it's his or her disease, it's her his or her affliction, it's his or her injury. He said that's so critical in our development as a species, because think about even in the quote-unquote enlightened West, how we dealt with people who were had epileptic seizures, for example. Anybody know? Witches, demonic possession, consort with Satan, people were burned, right? Drowned, stoned, right? And you end up with an awful lot of folks who suffered horrifically in the past because we didn't understand what was going on. Even dyslexia. 50 years ago, somebody didn't read or couldn't read because they were dyslexic. Why are you so lazy? Why can't you? Blah, 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 right? And so we've shifted the notion of how things should be understood, and therefore the notion of what should be punished. What we do with people who whose epileptic seizures cannot be controlled right now is we say you can't drive. Right? Nobody thinks that's a virtuous punishment. We just think that's realistic. But we don't stone them or burn them, right? That's something like progress, most people would think. Same thing is going to happen with all kinds of things that we don't know anything about right now. He has a point in the book where he says, think about the ways in which we view those otherwise sincere, you know, elites, if you want to call them that, from 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago, our ancestors who were acting in what they thought was good faith to protect the rest of us from these people who were showing signs of things that we didn't understand. And that, he said, we're probably going to be judged the same way. And that 100 years from now, people would say, I can't believe that you executed people who were suffering from severe emotional or mental trauma. I can't believe that you did this or that or the other thing, right? Because we just simply didn't know. So the point that he goes on to make is that, look, it's all biology. We just don't know yet what all of the factors are. So let me move ahead to a place where he talks about that more specifically. And of course, I don't have it marked, but he talks about a situation where, and I'm sorry to use this as an example, it's an example he uses and it makes sense, though, to me, it's going to drive the point home, and that is somebody doing work on pedophilia and proves without a shadow of a doubt, look, you know, almost all or all folks who are pedophiles have this particular affliction in the brain. They all image the same way. Said, you can't not be a pedophile if your brain is constructed this way. He said, but then the researcher goes on to say, but you can choose not to molest children. And Sapolsky and those who are in his camp say, yeah, you can not. In other words, it's very brave and correct for the researchers to get the point to say, this is not under somebody's control to be this. He said, but it's not very brave or correct of them to say that then they can choose not to act on it. He said, what we need to do, looking ahead, is to move from this notion that everybody might be afflicted in one way or the other, but at the same time, everybody can choose to act or not act on it, to understand that we don't actually have the free will to do that. But then the criticism comes in, said, well, how come some people who were raised under certain circumstances, you know, go on to become Harvard scholars, and many other people in the same circumstances go on and do terrible things and end up in jail? And he says, it's all multifactorial. And he goes through a long list of how and why each one of us presents quite differently, even at any moment throughout the day. And it is a long list, but it's, you know, what was your childhood like? You know, are you the product of a single parent home? What is your genetic makeup? Glucocorticoids, you know, what did you have for breakfast? It's on and on and on. I mean, it's a page and a half of possible factors that go in to help us understanding what any particular decision at any particular moment might look like. And so two people who might be sitting there presenting or seemingly have a very similar background, nonetheless are influenced by such disparate factors that the only thing finally that's going to be just to do is to turn biology loose and let it discover each and every one of these factors, tease all these things apart. And there's one point in the chapter where he says, you know, 50 years ago, there were 10 papers on this kind of behavioral aspect of human beings and the determination of biological and environmental factors. Last year, there were 19,000. He said, we're going to just exponentially come to understand ourselves behaviorally much better than we ever have in human history, and it's going to change everything. Or not. And here's maybe why not. And we were talking about this a little bit in the pre-talk, and sometimes I even wonder why I bother coming out here, because everybody already knows everything. But so, but at least the people who show up there, the people who least need to show up do. I don't know why. It's true everywhere, isn't it? So. But it's this particular aspect. So as we were talking about, you know, this whole notion of punishment is something that's been tricky for a long, long time. And we have changed and seemingly gotten better than we were, right? Don't immediately stone or burn people if they can't pass random, totally unscientific tests. But we still do an awful lot of incarceration, intervention of one kind or another that doesn't seem to be promoting justice or societal good in the long run. He said, if you come to understand biological determinism in the way that he's talking about it here, if we tease out these, you know, hundreds of different factors that make individuals who they are and do the things that they do, said, we're going to move from a kind of anger, punishment, maybe forgiveness cycle into one where it's understanding and treatment. Right? The problem with that is that for most of our history, and now we have the science, neuroscience to prove it, punishment, if we think that it's just punishment, feels good. Here's what happens. So Leslie has committed some sort of crime. I think we all know that's true. But so anyway, she's done something. The part of the brain that's activated when the judge or jury, whoever, is trying to decide the facts of the case, whether or not in fact she's guilty, that's all what's called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's all reason. It's all rationality, right? Let's lay it out and figure this stuff out. Then you hook somebody up who's deciding what the punishment should be. That person could be a judge or just one of us regular old lay people. And guess what gets activated? The ventromedial, I knew you knew that, but that's what gets activated. What's that indicative of? Emotion. It feels good. We want people to pay for what they've done. If they suffer a little bit or a lot, that's the way to go. Now, Sapolsky holds out some hope, and I actually think this is what's exciting and really promising about the kind of work that the biologists are doing. He said, well, geez, you know, if it's all bound up with our kind of, you know, emotional gratification and punishing people, that's exactly, in fact, why we're willing to pay so much money to incarcerate people, because it feels good. You know, I don't mind paying all this if it's going to make me feel this good to have a whole category of people or population of people put away. That's great, but we need then to shift that. And he's optimistic that we can because we've done it before. And he goes back to the example of epilepsy and says, you know, if somebody presents as an epileptic now, we don't punish them or think that they consorted with the devil. We have figured out what the actual causes are. As our knowledge expands, we figure out what the actual causes are of more and more behavioral problems. Guess what? We can shift our notion of punishment or due punishment to treatment. Now, ultimately, what's going to still satisfy our need to feel good about bad things happening to other people? He's not so sure. And I'm not so sure either. But if we're in this moment of not just biological evolution, but more importantly, a kind of cultural evolution, because we can use our brains to figure out what's happening in other people's brains, you know, how promising that might that be that we get, when people look back on us, they say, well, gee, you know, they were kind of slow and kind of cruel, but they were an important step in bringing us to the next level of understanding about human brains and what needs to happen in human brains and for human brains. In ways, and as we're talking this morning, in ways even that we can, determined though we might be, use our brains to figure out how we can decrease the incidences of people being mis or maltreated so that the predictability about how they'll act will also increase. So some really promising things long-term about what the biologists are coming up with, it seems to me. The treatment might be anything from brain interventions. The techniques are becoming more and more sophisticated all the time. Transcranial, magnetic stimulation, deep brain stimulation, all kinds of places to go with this. It seems to me the future, even beyond pharmacology, at least as I talk to friends who are neuroscientists and neurosurgeons. There is finally, though, one possible downside to this whole notion of giving up the idea that we have free will, at least, or even mitigated free will, but certainly free will in the sense that we can, you know, occasionally rise above all the other things that have factored into who we are. And it's great, right, if we're on the downside of something, on the negative side of something, we say, well, you know, of course, if it's severe, I still need to be, if not punished, put away. I still need to be in a place where I can't do the damage that I might otherwise do to other human beings. It drives Sapolsky and I think a lot of other people insane that people say, well, there still has to be accountability, you know. It's like, of course, you still have to be protected from people who are dangerous. There's no doubt about that. But when those people are put away, wherever they're put away, he says everything from the most sophisticated treatment facilities to the island of misfit toys. It's going to vary from culture to culture, right? But how that's going to go, A, we're going to learn a lot, and B, we'll be safer, and we'll understand what we're doing. But the downside for those of us who are doing great things, you know, writing amazing articles, for example, or giving public talks, I don't know. Let's see. Or playing the drums. I don't know. I can't think of anything else. Whatever it might be, you're an amazing cook, you're, you know, an amazing musician, you're all these amazing things. And you are used to having people come up to you and say, you're pretty amazing. And we're used to saying things like, yeah, I know, you know. And what this particular understanding of human nature and the brain and free will is going to lead us to is if one is honest, you're going to have to give all that up. You're going to say, I, in the sense of any kind of conventional ego, can't take credit for any of that. It's going to be products of hereditary environments that I was raised in, certain inclinations, traits that I can take no particular credit for. So I am going to say this is great on one hand because we're going to move from punishment, anger, maybe forgiveness cycle to an understanding treatment cycle, however difficult that's going to be. But I personally am loath to give up the praise that comes with my exercising my, not your, free will. All right, thank you.